Greetings, 99%ers. This is your host, Dr. Jack Rasmus. I hope you are hearing me clearly. I'm having a little bit of static coming from the station. If not, I'm sure we'll correct that shortly. Well, I guess I sound okay to you, so we'll go with it. All right, so today's show is focus on the growing integration of the economic and political crises in the U.S., and of course the health crisis, which is kind of the glue of that integration of economic and political going on. I call it the triple crisis. And I want to talk today about Trump's possible plan B for the November elections. And that, of course, is part of this triple crisis that I just mentioned, economic, health, political. Of course, the health crisis is getting worse, isn't it? Now that, quote, they reopened the economy. And we've got even an escalation of infections and death rates and so forth. We're going to have clearly possibly 200,000 deaths from COVID-19 here by Labor Day. And I'm sure it's going to be 100,000 more at least here by the time we get to November. The death rate by 2021 will be greater than that the U.S. lost in lives all during the World War II years. So this war will be, except for the Civil War of 1860s, in which we lost 900,000 people, this will be the worst, quote, war that we've had here, certainly in the 20th century, before it's over. Okay, I want to talk about Plan B. You know, the outlines of what Trump is planning to do are becoming clearer by the day. What is his electoral strategy, his Plan B? You know, Plan A would be simply to win the election fairly and legally and move on from there. But he's got a Plan B, I think, and I want to talk about some of the elements that I see of this Plan B beginning to come together. Of course, at the core of this is his plan to challenge the outcome of the November elections, should he lose. There are various scenarios, and even some academics have begun to speculate scenarios. You know, I think some Yale University profs provided some speculation on what could happen November 3rd. But, you know, I guarantee you it's not going to be a normal election. We will not know the results on November 4th. Guaranteed. This thing will not be resolved for weeks, maybe months after November 4th. And what we got leading up to November 4th is chaos on all fronts, on the health front, on the economic front now that Congress has convened, left Washington, no stimulus bill, no fiscal stimulus bill. We'll talk about that some more, what the implications and effects of that will be, and a growing political constitutional crisis between the presidency and the House of Representatives, with Mitch McConnell's Senate sitting back, you know, like a catbird on a fence, watching it all and chuckling. Yeah. Okay. So let's just jump right into this thing. We want to talk about first the breakoff of negotiations on the stimulus bill. I was quite surprised and did not fully understand at first that Trump's moves last week to break off negotiations and to issue his four executive orders here on Saturday within 24 hours, right? Not even 24 hours. Breaks off negotiations on Friday on the stimulus bill. The Democrats had come down $1 trillion. You know, they were making a reasonable effort, reduce their package called the HEROES Act, passed way back in June, which was worth $3 trillion, which included the continuation of the $600 unemployment supplement benefit, provided for additional supplemental income checks to folks, extended the PPP program for small businesses, provided more funds, provided $900 billion to bail out the states, which I'll describe are in increasingly dire economic straits here, provided hundreds of billions for testing and tracing and schools. You know, it was a true stimulus package. The CARES Act passed in March was not a stimulus. It was a mitigation, prevent the collapse even being worse than it was. But this would have been, the HEROES Act would have been a true stimulus, economic stimulus, which was, you know, really desperately needed for the economy because the economy has begun to weaken once again in the second half of July. And now, of course, it will weaken even more so throughout August. But maybe that's part of Trump's plan B. I'm beginning to think that's part of his plan B. So as much chaos economically, politically, as possible before the November elections. We'll see how that fits in with his post-November plans. Right? Okay, so back to the break-off of the negotiations. Clearly, this break-off was planned by Trump. Mitch McConnell, Senate, had stepped to the sidelines after it had passed this trillion-dollar, quote, HEALS Act, H-E-A-L-S Act, and which flopped here in early July. No interest in it. He stepped to the sideline because his troops were revolting. He had about 20% led by Rand Paul, who were saying, oh, too much deficit here. We're not going to be able to afford to pay for this. Well, you know, the same guy, Rand Paul, passed tax cuts and tax cuts, voted for them. That really created a deficit here under Trump. He had no problem with that, creating the deficits. You know, we were running well over $1 trillion deficits every year under Trump, mostly because of the tax cuts. You see, tax revenue is about 2/3 of the deficit cause. It's not so much the spending, although it contributes significantly, but it is the lack of revenues because you give tax cuts, too much of them, right? Or you have a weak economy and therefore tax revenues fall off as well. That causes most of the deficit. And under Trump, it was, you know, too much spending. Too much tax cutting. You know, $4 trillion tax cut initially, and then $429 billion more of loopholes last year. We had a serious budget deficit every year when the economy was supposed to be booming so well. Okay, so going into this crisis, we had a big deficit problem here. And of course, it's gotten much worse, again, largely because tax revenues have collapsed, and we'll get some figures on that shortly here. But this minority in the Republican ranks in the Senate gave McConnell a good excuse not to go ahead and try to force a vote on any kind of a package negotiated with the House Democrats. So he steps aside, and in comes Trump's boy here, Mark Meadows, his chief of staff, right? He takes over negotiations, and they play Meadows hard cop against Pelosi and Schumer, and Steve Mnuchin soft cop, right? Mnuchin gets the Democrats to come down $1 trillion, but they don't offer the Republicans anything in return, you see? And on Friday, Meadows stomps out, reportedly slams his papers on the table and stomps out in a very amateurish move. Okay, so they break off negotiations. Well, they had this planned, you see, well before. Use Mnuchin to second the Democrats and then throw it in their face, Meadows, and walk out. And within 12 hours, they had Trump's 4 executive orders. Yeah. One executive order, of course, was to cut the benefit, the $600 a week supplemental federal unemployment benefit, to cut it down to $300 by the feds, which they would only pay, by the way, for 2 months, and only if the states threw in another $100 billion. Well, they knew the states are broke. And as far as their unemployment funds, nearly, and the states, most of them would not throw in another $100. So that $300 offer, you know, to in effect cut the federal supplemental unemployment benefit in half, it really was all on paper. They knew it. They knew it. And that was only for 2 months, you see, because after that, if you read the fine print of the EO, they would fall back to a combined 70% of the person's income for their unemployment benefit at all, which is just impossible for the states to figure out. You see, the states implement and make the payment, you know, and the feds just give them the extra $600 or $300. So, you know, this was really an insidious kind of an offer for extending unemployment benefits, cutting it in half even, because they knew it would not be implemented. Also, they know the payroll tax cut, the second executive order, would not really be implemented probably as well, because it is a violation of law. You see, only Congress, according to the Constitution, can spend money, appropriate money. Article 1, Section 9 of the U.S. Constitution says, quote, no money shall be drawn from the Treasury except in consequence of appropriations made by law. In other words, only the Congress can decide how much to spend and not to spend. So Trump makes this move anyway, this payroll tax cut thing, for employees' share. You see, the payroll tax is really partly paid, half paid by employers and half paid by employees. Well, how much? Well, Social Security is 6.2% each taken out of paychecks. And Medicare is another 1.45% each, employers and workers. So we're looking at 15.3% total payroll tax. That's FICA on your check, F-I-C-A, right? People aren't aware, but the employer share, the 6.2 and 1.45, has already been deferred, already, under the March CARES Act. Employers are not paying that already. Now, it's a deferral, which means they got to put it back sometime by the end of 2021. It's a deferral. They stop paying their contribution. They're deferred. They got to put it back. Well, watch them forgive that altogether, my prediction. But the workers were continuing to have to pay the payroll tax. Well, now Trump's proposal is really about giving a deferral to the workers for their share of the payroll tax. They're 6.2 and 1.45%. But again, it's a deferral, meaning that the workers are going to have to pay it back next year. Yeah. Well, you know, that's just moving the money around. That's not really stimulating the economy that much. But even as a deferral, the problem is that under the law, the employers are the ones who have to collect the payroll tax for the workers as well. And then submit the payroll tax to the government, right? And they're worried. They're worried that, well, if they don't collect the payroll tax and pay it, they may get stuck having to restore that deferral as well as their own share. You know, this was the legal opinion going around. So the prediction was that the employers are just going to deduct the worker share and sit on it in an unused fund so that they wouldn't have to pay it later. That's why Trump said, oh, it's not a deferral, it's a permanent payroll tax cut for workers. Whoa, that set off a shitstorm, right? Because if it's permanent, first of all, he's just totally running roughshod over a law passed by Congress, right? But if it's permanent, how long is permanent? And the longer it goes, no money is coming into the Social Security trust funds. In other words, you're going to take it all away from grandma and grandpa. You're going to destroy Social Security. If it's got no money, it's destroyed, right? For how long? Well, people saw that clearly as a ploy to destroy Social Security and Medicare by taking away the funding. So you see, he was between a rock and a hard place. If it was just a deferral, the employers might hoard it. Workers would have to eventually pay it back if they paid for it, right? It really wouldn't have much effect on the economy. It certainly wouldn't help the unemployed, because if you're unemployed, you're not paying a payroll tax, right? So it was a bag of worms. The payroll tax cut was and remains a bag of worms and probably won't get implemented unless Trump simply wants to run roughshod here over the law once again, which is possible. The other two executive orders were just bullshit, you know? Oh, extend the student loan deferral here for another 3 months, right? Which was going to happen anyway, probably. I mean, how could, you know, 40 million, many of them students, unemployed, many of them students, pay their student loan? They couldn't. In other words, the defaults would have tripled and quadrupled overnight here without that. And then there's a moratorium on evictions. You know, in the CARES Act in March, about a third of the rental units. There's 108 workers who are renters, and about 108 million, and about 48 million rental units in the United States. Well, about a third of those were protected from evictions because they have some federal funding associated with the apartment constructions and so forth. So, you know, what they had here was, you know, maybe 20 million or so at the most, which were suspended evictions. Well, that provision ran out at the end of July, and the evictions now have accelerated, right? Even for that one-third that was protected. Well, what does Trump's EO, executive order, do with regard to those moratorium on evictions? Oh, read it. It just says, the state should consider extending the moratorium. The state, leave it up to the state, see? Could consider. There's no moratorium on evictions in his executive orders. So it's a lot of smoke and mirrors here in these four executive orders. There's not much there, really, you know? And I think one of the estimates by Chase Bank economist, this guy Michael Feroli, said, it would provide, if it's all implemented, less than $100 billion stimulus to GDP, less than $100 billion. And Oxford Economics says negligible. In other words, nothing. It's all smoke and mirrors. There's nothing to it. Well, why? Why then does Trump break off negotiations on a stimulus last week and throw out these four negligible, negative stimulus executive orders? There's nothing there, you see. Is this just a tactical move by Trump to get the Democrats back to the table? Apparently not, you see, apparently not, because, boy, there was no movement at all unofficially behind closed doors. I think he's broken off negotiations permanently. And that's purposeful, right? I think that he's really trying to create chaos between now and the election with a purpose. So Congress goes home here now, as of a day or so ago, and there will be no stimulus bill. There's just his four bullshit executive orders that are really smoke and mirrors, provide no stimulus to the economy, even if they're implemented, you see. And two of them are illegal. Really. I mean, the payroll tax cut violates the Constitution. And then the unemployment benefits of $300, if the states throw in $100 a week, we're talking about here, right? All of that. Where's he going to get the money for that? Oh, he's going to get the money, reportedly, from the Disaster Relief Fund. In other words, as hurricane season approaches here, he's going to take money from the Hurricane Relief Fund. Now, that's only $44 billion. And that will last, even paying out a reduced $300 a week. That will last about 5 weeks, and then it's over, you know. But that's illegal, too, you see. That's illegal because, again, it violates Article 1, Section 9 of the Constitution that gives the right to spend, to earmark, target where spending appropriations bills will occur. That's only given to the House of Representatives, the power of the purse, only the House of Representatives for a purpose. You know? Because if the executive, the presidency, has the power of the purse to spend, well, what does it need to compromise with Congress for? It doesn't. It will end up ruling individually, separately. And we will no longer have these checks and balances, for sure. And Congress will become an empty vehicle here, politically. And that's where we're moving, you see. Trump has already created the precedent for violating Article 1 when it came to his wall. What did he do? Well, couldn't get Congress to pay for his wall. So he just transferred money from the Pentagon to pay for his wall. So far, he spent $9.9 billion on that wall. $9.9 billion, and there's more allocated as well. He's going to build his wall, taking money from the Pentagon, and then he replaces the money taken from the Pentagon. Well, how's he do that? Well, the Republican proposal here for the stimulus includes $20 billion more for the Pentagon. Not that the Pentagon is in any economic trouble, right? Or the military-industrial complex building all these weapon systems. Now, that hasn't stopped at all. Yeah. So they'll just take it from one cubby hole and put it in another cubby hole. That's what he's doing. He's bypassing Congress, taking it from money allocated, appropriated, targeted, earmarked by Congress for the Pentagon, taking that and then filling up the hole later. Now, he's got that precedent, and it went to the Supreme Court. And the Supreme Court kicked the can down the road, remanded it back to the district court, a federal court or appeals court, I don't know which one, right? And you won't get a decision on that till after the election, which means, Trump saw a green light with the Supreme Court approving, you know, his attack on the Constitution and the House. And he's using it again. Yeah, he's using it again, taking disaster relief funds to pay for his phony unemployment benefits, which is going to last who knows if it's even going to be implemented, because the states aren't going to throw in the extra $100, and if they don't, the feds don't throw in the $300. They know all this. It's not news. Okay, so we have a breakoff. We have a breakoff of this negotiations and these four phony executive orders. And it's not tactical. In other words, wasn't designed to get the Democrats back to the table. No, it was designed strategically, I believe. It was a strategic move, not a tactical move in negotiations. It was strategic, where Trump would take control of the agenda and the chaos, economic deterioration that would follow in the third quarter, he would blame Pelosi and the Democrats. Oh, they wouldn't agree with anything, so I had to take direct action myself and pass these executive orders, you know. He takes control of the agenda, puts his pet proposals in there, and he's in the driver's seat. Oh, this is classic Trump. Classic Trump. You know, you suck your bargaining opponent in as far as you can, get them to reveal their positions, right? Then you break off negotiations and walk away. The art of the deal, you see. I've seen this before, many years, a union contract negotiator. You know, I've seen this kind of tactic before. And, you know, it's what we call bad faith bargaining in labor management relations. Bad faith. Yeah. You could walk out on strike if your opponent across the table acted that way. Bad faith bargaining. Yeah. And in fact, in past occasions when I, you know, was the negotiating chair, when the employer did that, I immediately walked everybody out on an unfair labor practice strike where you had to get paid back your lost wages, unlike a regular strike, if you prevailed and you proved it was bad faith bargaining, which we always did, right? This is bad faith bargaining, but it's a tactic that is really part of a strategy, you see. And the strategy is to sow economic chaos, right? Well, what does it mean here? Economically, the breakdown and breaking off, and now the collapse, the breakdown, you know, they broke off negotiations. Now negotiations have broken down. And Congress isn't coming back till after Labor Day. So $600 a week is taken out of paychecks for tens of millions of people, at least 14 million people. The average weekly unemployment benefit, when we had these two unemployment systems going, the regular state unemployment benefit system, which in some places pays you know, only a couple hundred dollars a week, like in Mississippi, for unemployment benefits. During the pandemic crisis and the CARES Act, that was up to an extra $600 for everybody, you know. And the idea was to get everybody to spend, to try to stimulate the economy. Well, the average was $812 a week while we had the federal program supplement called the Pandemic Unemployment System, which, by the way, covered workers who weren't getting unemployment benefits through the state system because they were gig workers or independent contractors and so forth. Right. They were the great beneficiaries of the $600. They wouldn't have gotten anything, as well as the state system. The two of them together provided $812 on average a week. Right. Now, according to the National Bureau of Economic Research economists, this is reduced to $257 a week. Yeah. You know, just about $600 benefit taken out of the economy for tens of millions. Well, how much does that amount to? $75 billion a month in less spending. $75 billion direct. Now, that doesn't count what we call the multiplier effect on GDP of that $75 billion. If the $75 billion gets spent right? And we have a multiplier of 1.5 or 2, let's say. That means the effect on GDP and the economy of that $75 billion is really $150 billion of spending, positive impact on GDP. Well, $75 billion in August for sure, or $150 billion taken out of the economy. And we're going to see that as well for September, because they're not coming back till after Labor Day. Yeah. And I don't think he's going to provide anything in additional unemployment benefits. So we're looking at least $200 billion or more taken out of the U.S. economy in the third quarter in just consumer spending, $200 billion, because of the failure, purposeful, to continue the $600 unemployment benefit. That's a big hit in a short time from the economy, and we'll probably see that repeated September and October, right? It's been estimated that consumer spending will fall by 44%. Those who would have gotten the unemployment benefits will reduce their spending by 44%. We're talking about tens of millions of people. Yeah. Now, how does this tie in with unemployment claims? Well, gosh, I'm getting tired of clarifying the scam that's going on, reporting in the media, including the liberal media, on the level of unemployment. You know, unemployment claims, new claims are announced every Thursday. Okay, and what do we have? Well, yesterday they announced, unemployment claims went down only 963,000 here in the past week. 963,000 only. Oh, for the first time, it dropped below 1 million for the first time. Huh. Well, what they're forgetting and not adding is the more than 1 million more who were filing for claims under the $600 federal supplement unemployment benefit program. They're gone away. So there's no filing by gig workers and independent contract workers and so forth. There's no filing there at all. So they wipe out over a million people. They're not filing because the program doesn't exist anymore for them. So, you know, it's been running, when you look at the state program, which is all for 19 consecutive weeks, has been over 1 million new claims every week. And you look at the federal supplement program, the PUC program, which has been over 1 million as well every week for 20 weeks, right? It's been every week, people, 2 million new unemployed filing for benefits. And of course, that's only those filing for benefits. There's always more people who don't even file for benefits, or they're having trouble getting the benefits. 20 consecutive weeks of 2 million plus people. And then back in March, it was like almost 7 million in 1 week. You know, we still have 30, 40 million people unemployed in this country. And it will take at least a half decade, maybe more, for those jobs to come back. Some will never come back, because what we're seeing is a lot of small businesses just going under, you know, closing their doors for good. Those jobs will never come back. And structurally, things will change dramatically in terms of investment and consumer spending. Certain industries will never come back to what they were. The airline industry will never come back to where it was. Entertainment, travel, no. Hospitality, no, never come back to a levels and where it was. So unemployment is going to drag on for a long time at very high levels. All right, so, you know, another big thing missing the Republicans and Trump would not agree to was the bailout of the state and local governments. An estimated $969 billion was needed to make up the loss of revenue for state governments and cities, about two-thirds of that for the state, one-third for the cities, that would occur between now and 2021. That was the estimate. Collapse of tax revenues because of, you know, shutdowns and so forth. Right? Nothing for that in Trump's proposals, his EOs, nothing. Purposeful nothing. I'll explain why. You know, we already lost 1.2 million jobs in government since March, and they're on the cusp of announcing even hundreds of thousands of more jobs. Local government, state, city government, is responsible for $2.3 trillion of our $20 trillion GDP that we had last year. $2.3 trillion, right? It's 11% of U.S. GDP. Well, it's going to be cut already and continuing by 20%. That's about $400 to $500 billion. It's estimated that the states are going to have to, and the cities are going to have to cut in terms of their spending. Well, that's a reduction of GDP. Right? You take out $500 billion. You know, $20-30 billion a month for the next year, and you add that to the $100-150 billion a month in the collapse or reduction, a further reduction of consumption due to the ending of the unemployment benefit, $600, right? So, you know, you're looking at easily $150-200 billion a month, $100-150 billion a month in the third quarter here. In terms of reduction to GDP because of the discontinuance of the unemployment benefit and the failure to bail out the states. Third quarter GDP is going to be a mess, right? And that, of course, is going to be dramatically slowed down. And that comes on top, of course, of our second quarter GDP number of 32.9% annualized collapse in the economic in the U.S. economy in the second quarter, April, June, 33% collapse, annualized rate, quarter over quarter, at least 10%. Now, the same thing's going on globally, by the way. Yeah, the numbers just came in for Japan. Its annualized second quarter GDP collapse, 27%. And then there's Germany. Right, in Europe, 35%. And then there's the UK, the Brits, 52% annualized collapse of their economy in the second quarter. Look, you cannot have that deep a collapse and have a rapid recovery. No, this inflicts severe wounds on the economy and adjustments in their spending and investing patterns by businesses that carry on for years. And now we have the failure for a stimulus in the third quarter. On top of all of that, does anyone really believe the economy is going to robustly recover before the election? Just not going to happen. Okay. So very serious economic deepening economic crisis on the horizon here. Right. Now, what does this mean for Trump's plan B? Okay, let me speculate a little bit here. As I said at the beginning, it appears to me that there are pieces of his strategy that are becoming clearer every day. His political strategy, his electoral strategy within that political strategy. Right? Well, first of all, it's about squeezing the blue states, you see. What he's trying to do is punish the blue states as much as possible. You know, most of the unemployment claims are in the blue states. Those are the urbanized industrial states, you know. So the unemployment is going to worsen disproportionately in the blue states, in the big cities. And there's no bailout, you see. They refuse to bail out the states because they say, oh, we'll be bailing out the blue states. Well, if you want to squeeze the blue states economically to try to turn voters against their Democrat legislatures and Democrat executive branches, right? Well, you're not going to bail them out. You're not going to give them any money. I mean, from the very beginning, McConnell was clear on that. Don't give this blue states any money, right? They want to squeeze the blue states. Why? Because, you know, maybe it'll make a difference on marginal votes in November in some of those states, you know, particularly, you know, states like Michigan, which Trump barely won, right? And it's one of those seven or eight swing states. You know, the election's all about the swing states. So, you know, punish the Democrats, punish the blue states. Right? You do that by cutting off the unemployment benefits, right? You do that by allowing the evictions to accelerate once again. You do that by refusing to bail out the blue states. At the same time, Trump's plan is to consolidate his red state base, right? Now, this is where massive voter suppression comes in, been going on for some time, getting worse. I mean, read Greg Palast's work, Trump Steals Election 2020, right? Based on his analysis, his investigative reporting of what's going on in some of these red states and voter suppressions, you know, most egregious, for example, in Georgia, recent election there where the black Democratic woman running for governor, Stacey Abrams, had the election stolen from her by this guy Kemp, who was the Secretary of State for Georgia and who wiped out hundreds of thousands of people off the rolls, the voter rolls. That's how he won. He just prevented them from voting. Oh, and the excuse at the time is, oh, these are felons. Well, you know, the same thing happened in Florida in 2000, right? They took hundreds of thousands of people off the vote rolls, said they were felons, they couldn't vote. Well, as it turned out, according to Palast, when they looked at the actual voters that were impounded because they were so-called felons, they weren't. And the same thing he's found with Georgia. You know, these were just claims that these people were felons, taken off the rolls, not allowed to work, to vote, their vote to count. And it was all false. And, you know, we got this voter suppression going on in at least a dozen states, and most of them are in the red states, his base. So it's all about his strategy of consolidating the red states using voter suppression wherever possible. Now we got another little tactical move by him. He's got this black entertainment fellow, Kanye West, right? Kanye West, who's going to run for president, you know? Get him on the ballot in Michigan where, you know, just a couple thousand votes made the difference. And maybe Kanye can, you know, disrupt that whole vote there in Michigan. So, you know, they're using this guy to stay in office. Kanye West, a black guy who thinks he's white. Okay. Mail-in voter fraud. Now, that's at the core of his strategy, and you can see it every day. Every day, mail-in voter fraud. Oh, it's going to be fraudulent. Oh, you can't, you know. This is his main message. You know, in other words, all the mail-in ballots here are subject to challenge because they're fraudulent. Yeah. He's going to challenge by injunctions and other means, before the election maybe, but certainly after, the vote count of these mail-in ballots only in the blue states. Yeah, because he's already said, oh, but Florida, their mail-in ballots are okay. You see? So it's going to be a very selective stop the vote. Stop the vote count. Yeah, at least that. Stop the vote count. Well, this is Florida 2000 all over again. But, you know, 2000, it only happened in one state. in Florida in three counties, and that was good enough for to give George W. Bush the election. The Supreme Court stopped the vote recount, stopped it. And that's how George Bush got into office. And the Democrats did diddle shit about it, really, threw in the towel. Yeah. Okay, so what we got is 1, 2, 3 mini Floridas coming up. Yes, he's going to challenge the vote based on vote fraud, and he's doing everything he can to create as much chaos in that vote area, mail-in ballot voting area. Well, reports are coming out now from workers in the union, the Postal Workers Union, that Trump's recent appointment to run the post office just a couple of months ago, this right-winger, DeJoy or DeVoy or something, right, is taking down the voting sorting machines. Yeah, he's reducing the sorting machines in the various areas, you know, these the main warehouses, you know, not your local post office, but the sorting regional places. He's taking down the machines, and he's not allowing any rehiring of anybody going. In other words, he's doing everything he can to create the story that there's crisis and the post office screwed it up. Create chaos, right? The Democrats want to fund, extra fund the post office, because now with the COVID thing, more people are not going to go to a voting station, right? They're going to vote by mail. And you got another problem, too, is, you know, it used to be that elderly people pretty much manned the, you know, the various voting locations. Well, they're not going to come out and do that. You can see a harbinger of that, what happened in recent elections in Kentucky. You know, what happened? Well, they reduced the polling stations, particularly in the minority areas of Louisville. There was one polling station where you had 14,000 people supposed to vote in one polling station. Well, you know, these red state Republicans are going to manipulate that as well. They're going to consolidate because they'll be able to say, well, we don't have as many people to man these stations. They'll consolidate the voting polling booth stations, and they'll do it mostly in minority Democratic areas, you see. They create these really long, you've never seen long lines at voting as you will see this November. Right? And, you know, create a chaos in the post office, you know, manipulate voter suppression, voting, consolidate voting locations. That's how he's going to hold on to and keep the red states, his base, right? And then issue injunctions to stop the vote count after the election in select blue states. Or maybe even before, test the water. Maybe he can test the water by getting one of his appointees to the federal judiciary, and there's been over 200 of them under Mitch McConnell. New appointments, the federal judiciary, get them to test the waters to see if they can stop the collection even of the mail-in ballots, impound them. You know, don't even allow them to be counted, let alone recount them. So the economic crisis is going to worsen. The health crisis, the COVID crisis, is going to worsen. Watch him announce here a vaccine for sure. Whether it works or not, he'll announce it. I was predicting that would be a part of his October strategy, but because the Russians and Chinese are so close to it, he may have to announce it even before. No, you announce it, but it doesn't mean anything until you implement it and you see whether it works. And there's no strategy here to roll out and decide who gets a vaccine nationally. Again, leave it to the states. Now, I think there will be also an October surprise in foreign policy. What might that be? Well, it's got to be either Iran or Venezuela or both. You know, they just announced this deal with Israel and the Arab Emirates, the UAE, Arab Emirates, right? Supposedly, they're going to recognize each other formally. Well, the UAE is really worried about Iran, right? And I'm sure they've been promised a lot of military freebies by Trump if they go ahead and agree and recognize exchange ambassadors, whatever, with Israel. And Israel supposedly is going to stop its forced settlements on the West Bank, you know, as part of the deal. Well, I heard this guy Netanyahu, and he said, oh, this is only temporary. Yeah, we agreed to this temporarily. In other words, this is all a move to make it look like Trump did something foreign policy before the election in the Middle East. But I think it's also a move. He's lining up his ducks. Right? He's lining up his ducks for some kind of move against Iran. And I think that's very likely here in October. You know, the headline in Wall Street Journal today, right under this announcement of the Israel-UAE formal ties establishing, is a headline about U.S. seizes Iran oil bound for Venezuela. Yeah, they seized 4 cargo ships, confiscated, loaded with Iranian oil, right, that was being provided to Venezuela, because Venezuela, you know, their oil production is way down because the U.S. has been sanctioning them and preventing any repairs and equipment that would have to come from outside Venezuela for their oil fields. There's a lot, you know, I wrote about that a lot in Financial Imperialism, The Case of Venezuela. Read the article on my blog, jackrasmus.com. Well, anyway, you know, we got this headline here about U.S. seizes Iranian oil. Something's going on. And it's related, of course, to lining up support here. And this Israeli-UAE deal is part of it, you see. Watch for something to happen, creating chaos in foreign policy as well. So, you know, you got the chaos in the election process here with the mail-in ballots. You got an increasing deterioration of the U.S. economy here in the third quarter, purposely. COVID is getting worse. We know that, right? So the health crisis, the economic crisis, domestic political crisis over the election, and a foreign political crisis here targeting Iran, Venezuela somehow, right? Use this multiple crisis or crises, right, to stay in office, you know? I think he's going to refuse to leave no matter the outcome. He's going to demand, well, we got to have vote recounts, and maybe we shouldn't allow some of the recounts. In other words, throw it in the courts. Drag it on for weeks, maybe months, beyond January 20th. Get the Supreme Court, his Supreme Court, maybe not to anoint him as it did in 2000, George W. Bush, anoint him as the president, but say, okay, you know, it's reasonable. We get a recount here and, you know, turn it into the courts, drag it on. Trump stays in office beyond January 20th, and the longer he stays, the stronger his position becomes. I think it's even possible, you know, given that situation, you're going to see mass protests, people marching into Washington. Because now we have, clearly, we have a move by Trump, should the scenario unfold this way, of usurping the authority of Congress, usurping the Constitution and the election, seeing himself above the law. That's a tyrant, by the way. Usurper is someone who steals the authority of other institutions, right? And dictate. In other words, rule by declaring national emergencies and executive orders. this is really a serious situation. I can't really emphasize more. Now, some may say, well, that's alarmist. You know? I think if you don't see what's emerging and the outlines, you're really myopic. You know, this guy will never leave office, never leave office quietly and in a normal fashion. And then if you have these mass demonstrations in Washington, I think it's even possible for him to call his right-wing grassroots supporters to come defend the White House, you see. And, of course, he has his own police force now called the DHS and ICE. You know, you could have a scenario where the DHS, you know, and the FBI, whatever, protect the inside perimeter of the White House, and then you got all these yokels here with their AK-47s standing around the perimeter, right? Who's going to go and take him out, move him out of the White House? You know, Nancy Pelosi says, oh, we'll remove him out. Ha! He's been a step ahead of you, Nancy, from the very beginning. I'm not convinced, you know. And you could have chaos in the streets in Washington, D.C., which is what he would like anyway, because the more chaos, the more justification for him staying in office and not changing presidents, you know, in the middle of a stream. So you could have domestic street problems and violence. You could have the economy getting worse, and certainly it will with all that political instability. COVID could be getting worse. And you got a foreign policy crisis. You know, I think these are all possible elements of where this guy is going and what we're probably going to see here with a further deterioration of this crisis, this triple crisis here that we have. And those are certainly some possible elements of his plan B. Right? In the meantime, you know, the economy gets worse. Certainly, with no agreement on a stimulus, it's going to get worse this third quarter. Fourth quarter, if we have this political crisis, it's going to get even further worse. And slowly, U.S. corporations are heading towards an Armageddon, a financial Armageddon, I believe, right? Default rates and corporate loans and debt supposed to go up to 10% here early next year. Chapter 11 filings up 30% just this year so far, right? 33% of small businesses said a couple weeks ago they would be out of cash within a couple weeks. One third of them out of cash in a couple weeks. 29% more in 2 months, 27% more in 3 months. If there's no stimulus to bail out small business, what do we got? You know, they're all going to run out of cash by November 3rd, let alone unemployed, let alone tens of millions of people being evicted. Wow, this is chaos, economic chaos on top of the political, health chaos. And then we have this eruption in the political chaos with the surrounding the elections. The U.S. has never been in a position like this similar since 1860. Anyway, that's my analysis, my take of possible scenarios here, economically and politically, and of course, you know, health-wise, as everyone, you know, a lot of people in the red states say, oh, you're impinging on my freedom not to wear a mask, right? My freedom to. Well, freedom also has an element of freedom from. In other words, the rest of us, you're impinging on my freedom from getting sick. Your freedom too is more important than my freedom from. Well, that's what these dummies don't understand, the true meaning of freedom, and it's dual dimensions. You can't be everyone freedom too when it steps on everybody's freedom from. Okay. Well, you know, 25% of the American electorate are dumb as nails. I'm sorry. And they're being manipulated by the right wing and the blogosphere and all these phony conspiracy theories. And that too, that cultural crisis is part of the overall general crisis underlying all of what's going on here in the U.S. So, closing statement, tighten your seatbelts, folks. We're in for a real ride here before the end of the year. All right, that's it for today. I'm out.